Hey, and welcome back to the A24 podcast. Our guest today met working on HBO's Emmy-winning hit series, Succession. While A24 has nothing to do with Succession, aside from being massive fans, we do know and love composer Nicholas Britell and actor Nicholas Braun. Britell composed the Oscar-nominated score for Moonlight, and Braun stars in our upcoming film, Zola. We recently set them up on Zoom, where they caught up and talked about getting out of their own heads, finding a creative rhythm, and of course, Succession.
So I guess we'll just start.
My name is Nicholas Braun.
And I'm Nicholas Britell.
And we are here with the A24 podcast via Zoom during pandemic.
I can't believe this is actually happening. There have been, you know, the technical setup has been extraordinary to make this possible. This is some hi-fi kind of apparatus that we've put together for this.
I'm surrounded by wires.
You're literally surrounded by wires right
just
now.
Just like telephone wires and ethernets and
there's so
cables,
much. I like what you did before where you opened the door.
Yeah, it was feeling a little choppy, the Wi-Fi airflow.
Yep.
And I think it just wanted to get in here and I want to let it in.
And you did, and now the Wi-Fi is flourishing. It feels flourishing. Where are you? Just so everyone knows, but actually, I don't know where you are.
I'm in New York.
Okay.
I live in the Lower East Side, so I'm at my place. I was staying in LA for most of quarantine. I was at a couple different friends' houses and living in guest bedrooms and back houses and things. But it feels good to finally be back in my bed in my home.
Sure.
And I missed the worst of it here, it feels like. But in the last 3 weeks since I got back, New York is kind of like re-burgeoning and, you know, the city's starting to get a pulse again. And,
for sure,
you know, people are sitting somewhat near each other at outdoor restaurants and stuff. And I feel good to be a New Yorker in a way still and like get some of this crazy, you know, time.
Absolutely. I mean, actually, it's interesting because I'm sort of the mirror image of that because Caitlin and I were in Manhattan for the whole period from basically early March until a week ago. And I like being inside. I'm really like a very indoors creature. I don't go outside almost ever, but this whole period of time has made me appreciate the outdoors in a whole new dimension, you know. And basically because we were so inside, I mean, I would say I probably went out of the building like 5 times over the 4 months, you know. I was really inside that much. And so we rented a place on Long Island just to kind of like get some air and you know, walk around some trees, etc. So I'm out on Long Island right now.
How does it feel to be away from the city and be not in your main dwelling? And like, because you said you built a home studio there, so like,
yeah,
what is the process different? Is it
It's interesting because like I've gotten used to over the past like, you know, 10 years. Over the past 10 years, I've been sort of making the regular pilgrimage out to Los Angeles, you know. And we've talked about it a bit, but like I love, you know, whenever I'm working with people, I love working in really close proximity. Like really, you know, I feel it's so important to work with collaborations like in the same room and to be there together. So I've gotten used to like moving equipment. You know, I always carry like this huge backpack and gear and stuff all the time. But you know, being sort of during this period of time, it's so hard to kind of just logistically do a lot of stuff. So I basically had to like set up this whole studio, drive all the equipment out, and it took a little while. I'm not gonna lie, it took a little while to get everything together, but I'm pretty set up now. Like I have a big screen because I always feel like whenever you're working on film or TV, I always feel like you actually need a big screen to work with. I've found over the years, that's a whole other conversation, but I've found over the years that like when you work with a smaller screen, you actually like do different stuff in a bizarre sort of psychological way, which is sort of
like,
strange.
Like you're not surrounded by the image in the same way as like a bigger screen.
Exactly.
So it's not like as impactful.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. Like I remember years ago I would work, like I have like a lot of different monitors that I use when I'm writing stuff. And usually I have sort of a main, like a 32 inch computer screen in front of me. And then I used to just have like a 20 something inch screen to my right, and I used to put the picture over there, you know, so I'd have like kind of my session in front of me, and then I'd have the movie on the right. And there was something about it where I was like, I don't know, I just had an inkling that that wasn't optimal. And I remember getting a much bigger screen, like a 50 inch screen, and putting it up in front of me, like above the other screen. And immediately I felt like a new door opened up. It's like exactly like you said, it's like you need an immersion in whatever you're doing, in whatever does that for you, you need to do that basically. And
yeah, like it shouldn't be in your peripheral vision sort
exactly.
of.
Exactly.
Like it should be the thing that's like in front of.
Exactly. And I bet the I think the metaphor works for like everything. Like that's just, I mean, that's maybe very specific to like what writing music for a film, but I feel like, I wonder for you, like, I mean, thinking about ways of immersing in a performance, for example, you know, I mean, there's always different, like, you know, techniques or thought, like, I'm actually just curious, like, for performing, like, do you think about that too? Do you think about, like, before you're going to do a scene, for example, are there things that you do to kind of immerse yourself psychologically or?
Yeah. I think I grow these little compulsive things for each role.
Uh-huh.
That, almost like, you know, like Nadal has like ticks he does before every serve. Like all
oh,
these,
yeah.
Like,
right. Right. Things. You just sort of, yeah.
You know, like he's touching his forearms and sweat and pulling his hair and stuff. I feel like I grow these things for the individual role, that I'm like, I grow my nails out, or that I have dirt under my nails, or that I don't sleep as much, or that I eat more or I eat less, or I.
So they're in character. Are you doing it because you think like, oh, the character would have like the dirt under the nails, for example, kind of thing, or is it more random? It's more kind of just like another
genre. It's definitely character based. It's like, it's, you know, I don't, there's no perfect way to create like an energy or a frequency for your character, but I'm like, if I don't shower, or if I, you know, don't talk to people the day before, or if I'm super social, whatever the character is, or whatever I think the frequency that I should be on for the next day is.
Sure.
I try to kind of cultivate that. And, you know, you can't like stop life from happening and certain things from happening, or you can't like not talk to your family for 3 months because your character doesn't talk to their family. You know, like I don't go that far with it, but I do try to find things that, you know, it's like, I would prefer to grow my hair out for something that requires it, as opposed to wear a wig, you know, grow the real facial hair, or, you know, make my body really feel like the way that that character's body feels like. Cause you kind of can't, like, the voice of somebody is not altered by just like changing it 2 seconds before. It's like, you have to sort of live in the body and live in the clothes and the posture, and all those things kind of contribute to the thing that shows up on screen.
That's,
you know, or
totally.
It's just the energy you bring into a scene with somebody. Like an actor is going to feel me differently. It's fun because you kind of get to rewire yourself for a short period of time and just be this
Absolutely.
Different thing, you know. And my character smokes cigs, so all of a sudden I'm smoking some cigs, like,
right,
you know, and I'm like doing this thing, and it helps my voice because it dries my voice out, or you know, or makes me feel a little bit sick. Oh, I got a sinus infection from smoking cigarettes. Well, my character, maybe, I don't know.
Maybe
it's like,
it changes you. It changes you, basically. Yeah.
It changes you. Yeah. So there's not a huge method to it. Like I wouldn't call myself like method actor or any of that. I like the idea of trying to figure out what is the way that this person feels all the time. And can I get as close to that as possible, while also not like, you know, being an impossible person in my life to be around for shooting stuff.
It's like a balancing act where you're exactly. Like I'm sure for windows of time that can be really fun. You know, it's like almost like a little bit of an escape from yourself in a sense. And then other time, and then you're sort of like, also you have to live your life though.
It's exactly that. It's a little fun escape, and doing the research is fun too. Like, I don't know why this just popped into my head, but I was going to play a juggalo character. Do you know what a juggalo is?
A juggalo?
Yeah. Have you heard of juggalos before?
No, wait, tell me more.
A juggalo is a fan of this rap group called Insane Clown Posse.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You know, they paint their face with clown makeup and stuff. And my character on the page was hung with a lot of juggalos. So I thought, well, maybe they're a juggalo and I should investigate this so I properly represent the Juggalo culture.
To be more closer to it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. To be closer to, like, what, you know, what are those people like, and what do they feel like? And, you know, what is the actual Juggalo hairstyle, and what, you know, what's their vibe and wardrobe and stuff. And I got the part, the movie didn't end up happening, by the way, but I got the part. And then a week later was the Gathering of the Juggalos, which is a yearly music festival where all these sort of Insane Clown Posse branch off groups, like inspired by ICP, come to perform. Anyway, it's a kind of crazy event, and people camp there for a week. And so I could get there on the last night of the festival, and I flew to Oklahoma City.
Amazing.
And I brought a tent, and I decided to just, like, be in character, and I got a grill for my mouth, and I did my hair kind of weird, and I, like,
incredible.
First thing I did when I got there is I bought an ICP t-shirt, you know,
like, you're just so like, I'm doing this.
Yeah. I'm doing it. Yeah. And my little brother flew out from San Francisco. I flew from LA. We both, like, met up in Oklahoma City and camped out at the Gathering of the Juggalos for a night. And that kind of stuff is so fun to me.
Yeah.
Like, to be able to do that, have an excuse, like, this is for work, you know,
right.
But really,
right.
It's also just a fascination, and to get to be around a group of people that I'm normally really not exposed to, and, like, be in a mosh pit, and, like, the big finale of their festival is Insane Clown Posse, which is a duo, this rap duo.
Yeah.
They bring out cases and cases of 2-liter Faygo, which is their soda brand that they created, and they pour it all over everybody like a baptism.
Oh my god!
At the end of the festival.
Oh my god!
And as many people as could fit on the stage.
So you got poured on? You got poured on?
Oh, fully doused in root beer and orange soda.
I always sort of talk about how, like, every project is a different, fascinating assignment where it's like, oh, you know, we need to explore this whole world. And then you get to say to yourself, okay, well, what do we do with that world? You know, what, like, from my perspective, it's like, okay, what music works with this? Because there's always the sort of first layer, like the first idea. You see something and then you can think, okay, well, this is the direct answer to that, or this is the reflection of that. But often I feel it's not the first, or it's almost never the first thing that's right for something. It's usually some sort of the second idea or the third idea. And actually, it's funny, like, have you ever talked to McKay about this? Because he would talk about how he put this really well a few years ago to me, where he studied with Del Close in Chicago for improv.
Yeah, right.
And I remember him telling me, I'm pretty sure, I don't want to misstate this, but he was saying basically how Del would always talk about how it was like the third idea was the one that you, like, when you're doing improv, that your first idea is sort of like not the right idea. Then your second idea is sort of kind of, it's maybe better, but it's like still related to the first idea. So it's not the idea. But the third idea, that's the idea. That's the one you go with, because it's like you've learned from the first two ideas, but the third one is like the new thing. And then I think he was telling me that, like, the fourth idea is like too far. that's like you're in your own head, kind of a thing. And he was saying, which I found fascinating, the idea that that really amazing improv is about so quickly getting to the third idea. So it's like in your head, you get to the third idea almost like right away. Like you cycle through the idea so quickly, and then you're already at the third idea. So it seems like you're immediately having this response, but it's a trained kind of like going through ideas very quickly. And I think about that after he said that to me. I mean, I think about that like almost all the time now.
It's just going to be in my head every time.
You know, it's like, what's the third idea?
But I think that makes a lot of sense. You know, the first one is basic, essentially. Mm-hmm. And then the second one is you're trying to beat the basic.
Yep.
And so the third is an original idea in the context of what you're doing.
Exactly. It's like the new discovery, still connected, but has evolved.
Yeah. Wow, that's really cool. So when you're coming up with stuff, like, let's talk about that. You'll get a first instinct towards something. Do you say, like, don't trust that, or sometimes is that right and you're like, it's actually pretty close, I just needed to tweak a thing or reorient it or something? Because so much about music, I feel like, is instinct, and it just comes out so expressive, and it's what your ear hears, right? Like you hear melodies and you hear instrumentation and you feel it innately. So then do you have to put on the academic brain sometimes and be like, that is good, but there is a deeper, better version?
That's a great question. I think it's all related to this stuff where part of it is hopefully over time, you know, we're learning and maybe we're honing our instincts so that, you know, maybe more quickly you start having a learned sense of, I know I could do that, but I'm not going to do that. You know, maybe because you're like, I know that'll work, but maybe that's not interesting, you know, or maybe I've already done that. I don't want to do that, you know. But I also think the crazy thing I think about film music is, and you know, film and TV music as a sort of entirety, is that like you can write all sorts of music. You know, you can come up with ideas away from the picture. Cause in a bizarre way, I guess what I'm saying is like writing music for a picture is both writing music and working, being a filmmaker, you know? So the music on its own could be really interesting. You know, you know, there could be something really cool that you like where you're like, I'm proud of this, I think it's beautiful. And then when you put it up against the picture, it's totally wrong. And so there's this kind of like dual layer where you're writing music and you're also testing it out, kind of is the way I would put it, where you're doing, I always talk about it as like you're doing experiments where you actually, it is maybe almost like a scientist where you have like a theory, you know, you have your best theories, but ultimately until you do the experiment, which is putting it against the movie or the screen, you have no idea. And sometimes you're like, wow, this really works. And then other times you're like, wow, that is so wrong. But now that I see that it's wrong, it's telling me something about what could be right.
Yeah. How do you know, I guess, how much experimenting is there? Is there always a phase of, okay, here's my first instinct without picture, and this is what my gut tells me based on the script, based on this director and what they've told me, like, this is the sort of thing I think is the foundation. And then is there always that phase before you see frames of a movie?
I think I always think, yeah, like even if I just hear about a project, I think I just love playing around with this stuff, you know? So like, even if I'm not working on a project or I hear about a project, I think I naturally start going, oh, I wonder what would work with that, you know?
Wow, wow.
And so I think like for example, on Succession, I, you know, I first heard about it, it might've been even while we were still doing The Big Short. I remember, you know, I came to set, Jeremy and Brian are having that, you know, do you want to hit me? Yeah, exactly.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. But that was sort of like, for me, that was incredible because I got to, like, you know, like you're talking about, I mean, immersing, you know, and
yeah.
you know, just feeling the tension in the room with that happening. Although it is intangible and it's all, but I really believe that all this stuff affects you subconsciously in a lot of ways, and almost like a mystical way. Like if you're around this stuff and you feel it, it's gonna affect you, and you're going to bring that into your work somehow, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's been interesting and great having you at Table Reads.
I'd love to go. That's been so much fun for me.
I think you started in second season, right? Like you were there at the first.
I came, it was second season, I think, or did I might have come to one in the first season, but definitely second season for sure.
And
I went to the writer's room too, actually. I went to the writer's room when they were writing season two as well in London, actually.
I mean, I think it makes a lot of sense. Like you're trying to sort of get what are the rhythms and what are the colors of the season and how's it changing? And
exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And actually, I'm just curious, like, when did you first learn about Succession? Like, what was that process? How did you hear about it?
It was sent to me kind of like most auditions get sent to you. You get, you know, the script and you get some of the sides. I got a few Greg scenes and you know, it said, I'm going to meet Adam McKay and I'd never met Adam, but I like long revered him and
he's the best. And, yeah.
You know, so I was like, this is crazy. This is great. I get to meet Adam. Okay.
Totally.
And I understood Greg, I think. I don't know if I understood where he fit. Actually, I think I understood, like, he is an oddball in this world.
Hmm.
You know, his energy is different. The stumbling nature of him and the awkwardness and the sort of forced ambition of it all is, like, very clear to me. I was like, okay, I'm just going to give it a shot. And Adam liked my read, and he did a bunch of like improv sort of things with me in the room. There are these sort of open-ended scenarios that he gave Greg.
What were they? I'm curious. Yeah. What sort of, yeah. Do you remember them or?
I do. Yeah. So there's the scene in the pilot where Greg is in this training room and he's really high. He smokes a little weed in the car, and then he's sitting in the room and he's in like 80% of his dog costume.
Yeah.
And the orientation person is giving the kind of corporate seminar and like all the guidelines. And he was like, let's just keep the scene going. What if there's a gunman at the amusement park? What would you do in that scenario?
Right, right.
And as Greg, I just started answering these questions and you know, he gave me like 10 scenarios and it just sort of, I mean, for me, it was great to, you know, like I was saying earlier, like it's great to get into the pathology of somebody
totally.
With improv. So how does your mind
right.
in this character answer a question?
Right,
it's not the way I'm going to answer it. So I have to redirect and go, oh yeah, Greg. So Greg's fearful. He wants to say the right thing, but he has no understanding of corporate like culture. So frisk him. I could frisk, you know, or escort him or get on the ground. You know, I mean, I don't know what I actually said, but I think it was really fun to understand. Okay, where is he? And at that point in the show, he's like so squirrely and weird and
right. And you were supposed to be high in that scene too, right? Like you're supposed
and
to
I'm
already
high.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So he's
so he's all of the above.
I can't even really understand the questions that well.
Right. Exactly.
That you know, just wants to get out there and put the costume on and
just get through the day. Yeah. Just get through. Yeah. Yeah. Do you know one thing, actually, it's funny when you said, you know, frisk or escort. Yeah, I feel that Greg has such a fascinating kind of affinity for words, actually, you know, and language. Like that really comes out in the congressional hearings in season two, you know, where you're sort of inhabiting that universe of like the like almost like court procedure words, you know, where you're sort of like, if it is to be said, you know, so it is. Is that how much of that is like you like because it sounds like you now fully know how to inhabit Greg, and is that was that mm-hmm. in the, you know, was a lot of that in the writing, like had they thought that Greg would talk this way, or is that something too that you've sort of like brought into things, you know?
I'm pretty sure it was in the writing.
Wow, that's awesome.
I'm pretty sure it's there because in the pilot, I remember there's this scene, and it did stay in the pilot where I'm sitting with Brian, in between Brian and he, I'm in the car, and I'm saying, you know, if there's a way for me to scratch your back and
you know,
and you scratch mine, or not my, you know,
yeah,
something, and I use the word perspicacious.
Amazing. Yes,
I believe that's the word I use, and so I'm like, you know, it tells you a lot about the way Jesse sees Greg.
Totally.
Is that he is scrambly in his thoughts and appears maybe dumb, but has this vocabulary weirdly.
Right. Right.
Or maybe he just like thinks around rich, smart people, he's supposed to use the big words he knows.
Right. Right. But he's trying to, it's like, it's the code. He's trying to fit in. As if like, and the irony being that the last thing in the world that Logan would ever use as a word like that, you know, he's like exactly. When they're quoting, you know, Shakespeare to him, he's just like, you know, fuck off.
Totally, keep it as simple as possible. Yeah. Just say what you want.
Exactly, like why are we here? Yeah. But yeah, it's interesting too, because it feels like you, I mean, you know, I obviously I've been working on Succession, but I'm a fan of all of your work, and I feel like the, you know, all the characters, all the actors are inhabiting in such a deep way. And it, you know, so like you were saying before, when you're talking about preparation and immersion, do you find yourself even, are there certain, obviously Greg has a sort of physicality in his way too. Like, do you now sort of naturally kind of, like if I were to say to you, you know, like, okay, you're Greg the Egg right now. You know, do you naturally sort of, does your body feel differently? I'm just curious, like how, you know, or would it take you time? Like you were saying, is it sort of like, give me 2 hours and I'll be Greg kind of a thing, you know?
I think that's it would be in the wardrobe and putting on a Greg style suit or outfit.
Okay.
And then it would be, yeah, the posture kind of changes. And I think the voice changes a little bit. And then there's just an energy that kind of ticks up. That's a, like a little bit more hyper aware of the room, the key players in it.
Right. That's a good point. Actually, it's very, Greg's very sensitive to the room. Right. But also like one of the things I love about Greg too, is sensitive to the room, but also like oddly self-centered as well. You know, like the way, like I still remember that moment where you say like, it's Gregory. you know, like in the midst of this, you know, like lion's den, you're still like, well, actually, please call me Gregory.
Yeah. Demanding something.
Exactly.
For his identity.
For his identity.
Yeah, for some, like, for some respect.
For some respect. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. I think that's totally the balance. He's like, I got to do the right thing. Got to do the right thing. But I also got to really do what I want to do right now.
Right.
And go for what I want.
Exactly. Which is remarkable because it's such a... you know, in that environment, there's also the fact that Greg does have these ambitions, you know, and is actually incredibly ambitious, you know, willing to walk in the, you know, in the bathroom and be like, I'm out of here. I'm out of here, Logan.
Yeah. He's trying to negotiate
yeah.
with him, like even at his big night.
Exactly.
Yeah. I love that part of him. I mean, I think that for me is one of the most exciting parts about Greg, is that all the things that, or the sort of ambition that I myself sort of put a dampener on, and I'm like, no, don't go up to that person and say that right now. Don't, you know,
You read the room.
I read the room. Greg reads it and he's like, everything is available. Where do I want to go the most right now? And so, yeah, there's just that kind of freedom of like instinct and excitement and saying thoughts that are inside your head that most people don't say out loud.
Yeah.
And I love that. I mean, that's a fun day to get to have.
It's
just
awesome.
Being that.
It's awesome watching you. And also I think, you know, I'm curious too, like, it seems to me like the whole cast, you know, you all have gotten to know each other so well. Do you feel, you know, similarly to preparing yourself, how much time do you all spend together? Because from what I can tell, you know, it feels like this real family to me, you know, and the way that you all interact, it feels like you have almost like a second nature where you just know, like you respond to each other so naturally in those roles.
Yeah. I don't know how, but I think it just got built really quickly. You know, I think Adam probably set us up perfectly in just sort of throwing us into these rooms and saying, you know, say whatever you want to each other. Kieran, you try something. And Nick, you start the conversation at the table. And everybody basically gets permission in that way to embody your character, see what happens. Like, we'll use it. Maybe we won't. Maybe it helps. Maybe it doesn't. But when you're put into that kind of initiation with a group of people, and you know, in the pilot phase, it's all a mystery. You're all buying into something that isn't a sure thing.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, let's just go for this. All right. Let's see. I mean, that felt good. That felt funny. What is this show? Like, is this a drama? Is it a comedy? Am I doing this right? I mean, everybody's just wondering. So I think Adam kind of neutralized that in a good way, which was just sort of like, try it all, you know?
Well, that's
try
the beauty.
Just try it.
I love that so much. I mean, I think Adam, you know, and I would say every good, collaborative relationship, I feel in some sense, in the kernel of it is like that, where basically, I mean, Barry Jenkins, and I mean, it is so that type of thing where there's just an openness and a trust to things. And Adam and Jesse, you know, are the same way for me too, where it's like, there's no wrong answers. If anything, they would be upset if you didn't present something that was an idea. You know, that's the only thing that would be bad, is if you don't share an idea that you're having. Because no one, like Adam always says stuff to me like, you know, he'll always say, the movie's gonna win in the end. It's not about any one of us, it's about the project. If it's a good idea, it'll make the whole project better. So let's all share our ideas.
Yeah, I think you, on Succession, you show an idea and usually it helps Jesse understand his scene better, or the director, you know, Mark usually,
totally.
But they'll sort of be like, oh yeah, no, wait, that's, good, stick with that and then do this on top of it. Yeah. So I want to, so in terms of like other projects, like what is, I don't know, has there been a crazy process that happened that was like not your, your ideal way and it turned out okay? Or like, what are some sort of like odd circumstances maybe that you've created music or things you thought sure. certainly wouldn't work and did? Like,
oh, those are good. Yeah, I think I spent a lot of time during and after college doing a lot of short films, you know, because I feel short films are like, in a lot of ways, I think people don't appreciate enough how crucial short films are to fit the film industry, and that short films are like a really tangible way that filmmakers learn how to make movies, you know? I mean, I certainly learned a lot about how to score things just by, you know, working with friends who were making shorts and every single one just trying different things and experimenting and really, really leaning into it that way. I mean, people might not know, I was a cocktail pianist at one point in high school, actually. I used to like play, I used to play cocktail music for like fundraisers and, you know, Whoa. Private parties. And then I actually, after my freshman year in college, I had this whole, you know, I mean, it was a tough time. Like I guess freshman year, I really wasn't sure what to do with myself just in life. When I was growing up, I always thought I was going to be a concert pianist. And basically sort of like late high school, I started thinking to myself, maybe I'm not going to be a concert pianist, you know? So I took a year off after my freshman year in college to give concerts and basically spend my days like just playing the piano all the time. And that yeah. was the year where I did a lot of cocktail piano, you know, which was a whole other world. And I mean, as far as other stuff too, I even wrote like telephone hold music, which was really interesting. I've done, you know, I just love writing music. So before I knew how to get gigs, I had a friend who worked at a restaurant who reached out to me and was like, so I got a gig for you. And I was like, oh, what is it? And he's like, the restaurant needs hold music. Would you, you know, do you think you would do something? And I was like, this is incredible. I'm so excited. Like, he's like, there's no pay, but they'll like buy you a drink. And I was like, let's do this. So, you know, I wrote this kind of like spa music that I thought would be relaxing when you, you know, get put on hold. And my friends were so nice. Like they would call the restaurant and they'd be like, oh, could you please put me on hold? You know, like, so they could like hear the music, you know? So those might be some unexpected gigs. You know, we all wow. have unexpected gigs, right? Like you, you know.
That's such a cool way to release music. Like,
hey,
all right, know, here's my new track. Call this number.
Call this number. And it also makes you appreciate too, like how, I mean, the many places that music does exist, you know, that is every place you hear music, somebody worked
created that.
On the, exactly. You know? And, the lesson to me was just like, if you're this excited about writing music for literally any possible context, it must mean that you really like writing music, you know? And I think those were the, those were kind of the lessons I think I was having to myself, sort of like everyone's trying to figure out what to do and you don't know enough because you haven't lived enough. And the thing that I started realizing was just, how did I want to spend my day? If I could structure my day in any way, what would I do? And I was in a band in college and I was scoring friends' movies. And I realized that if I was just writing music all day, I'd be pretty happy. So, you know, so you just start figuring out, well, maybe that's what I should be doing.
And were you able to make enough money like doing stuff in college, or was it you had to have a side job? And
not at all.
This was the passion.
Okay. So in college, so the cocktail gigs were great, but I mean, there were only so many opportunities for that.
So many cocktails college. That can
There's
be drank.
Not that many, not that many opportunities for that. So I was also an organist. I was a church organist in the summers. In Colorado, I was the Jewish organist in an Episcopal church, which was fascinating. Those were some of the musical ways in college that I would try to make some money. But you know, I think for film and TV and the arts in general, I think it's like, it is a long-term investment process. You know, it takes a long time. It takes so much work and so many projects until you start hopefully getting the opportunity to get really paid for it.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Have you had moments where, I don't know, you're on the trajectory, but you're like, I don't know how to get to the next rung of this. Like I'm scoring for friends' shorts, and but how do I actually score
what
a feature,
do you do?
Or how do I score somebody that doesn't even know me? Or I mean,
absolutely.
You had some moments where you're like,
Yeah, I mean, and it's interesting too, because I think it speaks to the whole industry as well, where it's like certain industries are structured in ways where they're more like, where there's a more obvious on-ramp in a way. You know, I've been talking to some friends about this just in the context of the world today, where it's like, you know, if you think about like being a lawyer or being a doctor, let's just say as an example, you know, there are certain schools that you go to and you get an approved degree of a certain sort, and then it leads, there's kind of a track. And I think arts and entertainment is much more amorphous. It's much more, it's much more unclear how, what that on-ramp is, you know? And I, one thing I've been spending time thinking about is like creating more ways to like demystify the process or do mentorships. I've been trying to teach a bit and talk about that, because I think it's, I think it, that way we will get more, you know, there's just so many incredibly talented people who either don't have an opportunity to do this or who don't even, aren't even exposed to the opportunity, you know, to know that they could be amazing at it. In a way, I think Hollywood is a freelance industry. Like almost everybody is freelancing. And free, like for example, freelance musicians, you know, it's like a, we're all gig to gig, which has opportunities because you're flexible and you can take on new projects and you go from one cool thing to another. But also there's a sense of, what is the structure? What's the stability of the structure over long periods of time?
I know, I wanted to talk to you about that because you have a really good work schedule, work structure. Like you are very busy, and obviously like you have your studio at your home, so you can just do it whenever. But how do you continue to churn and work and always stay inspired? I mean, you know, for me, I've done a little bit of music, but when I do it, it's because there's something in me that's like, okay, I got to write a song. And it comes out of some urge that's in that moment, or something happened that inspired words, or, you know, whatever. But you do this every day and you're able to, like, I don't know. I would just love to hear like how that works. And if some days you wake up and you're like, I don't know how to make music today, but then somehow you do, you know, or if it's a process of like, you're making a lot and you're like, I know I'm going to make X amount of music and some of it will just be unusable.
I think it's a combination of things. I think in college, when I was in my band, I would make, you know, a lot of beat, like I was hugely into making and producing hip hop beats, and I would work. I mean, I was making so many tracks every day, you know, I just loved it. But one of the things my friend Jake and I would do is we had this sort of rule for ourselves, which was, it sounds really basic, but we felt it was like the most profound realization. And all it was that we said, if it feels good, keep going. And if it doesn't, stop. And that was the rule. And it was, when we figured that out, it was like a revelation to us, because I think there are these times where it's something, you know, something's like not quite working, but you're like, no, I'm going to like push it through. It's like, don't. Just stop. Just go away. Just pause. Do something else and come back tomorrow. And the weirdest thing is like time tells you everything, you know? Like I feel and also it takes the pressure off those moments where a lot of it is like, you know, yes, you want to just experiment with things and you just try something. And there's no way to know beforehand if it's anything ever is going to work. You know, I literally never have any idea if something's going to work. I just do it and then I don't judge it, and then 24 or 48 hours later you come back to it and you're like, oh, that was kind of interesting. And then the other one you're like, oh wow, never play that ever again.
Sometimes when I'm making music, it comes out in this flurry, and then I think back and I'm like, whoa, those 4 hours, I don't know how I came up with that. I don't know how any of this happened, but it just happened. Do you have that, like, you know, is that a part of the process that you're just like,
I think whenever music or art is intellectual in its like execution, I don't think it works. I think it has to be kind of visceral, you know, like in a way, like you study things, you learn about technique, you practice so that in the moment you don't do any of that and you just go kind of from your gut, you know? And in a way, I think it's like what you were talking about with performance. You know, I mean, I think the moment that you're writing something, let's say, is kind of like a performance that you just freeze and then you work on it. You know what I mean? Like every idea that ends up being finished at one point was just like it emerged as almost improvisation. And then you edit it and you choose and you say, no, I don't like this. And, you know, so that first kind of moment of something, in a way, for everything is always a performance, you know? And so it has to be, like, I'm sure if you're on stage or in front of a camera, you know, that moment is that special thing, right?
Totally. That's why when you do ADR, which is the redoing of your lines in a studio 6 months later, it's so weird because there's so many factors that just happen out of thin air in a room with somebody with cameras happening to be there, but you just can't recreate that later.
But that speaks to like what you were saying earlier. Like, do you, for example, for ADR, do you do even more of a kind of immersion?
You know, I try to wear something that was similar maybe. And I try to, if my body's like moving, I gotta move while I'm saying the line, or I don't know. Do you do a lot of face imagining, like imagining that person there and
like literally like mental kind of visualization?
Or I guess sometimes you're looking at a face on the screen, you know, the screen's in front of you. So you're looking at them, and so you're trying to basically talk to a screen version of a human that you used to be actually
with. That was
with.
You, that you were talking to. Performance stuff is fascinating, though. I think that's that could be a whole other hour of conversation, because I feel like thinking about preparing for things is such a big thing. And
I know, I kind of struggle with that too, because sometimes when you're on set and something is a super important moment for you, and, you know, sometimes you've been thinking about this one scene for months or a year or something, you know, so you've been preparing for this moment, and then somebody is there and they want to have a conversation about like basketball, like the NBA, I don't know, like whatever, craft services, like it's so weird how the coffee tastes today or something. And that's a part of onset culture too. But, you know, sometimes you just have these distractions and it's hard to separate. And then sometimes you want to use them. Like, for instance, in that Succession Congress scene, there's a room full of background actors there and photographers and fake senators and all this stuff. And sort of, I want to look at them and use them beforehand and get some of that energy maybe.
Right.
Or you can kind of get thrown, but then sometimes you also want to use it.
That's really smart. That's where you're so in it already, actually. You've already spun it in your favor.
But it's different when you're playing piano in front of a group of people, you know, it's this piece that's extremely specific. Like, I'm thinking about, because I saw you play in that pre-college Juilliard night, you know, that's a room, it's a symphony hall full of people, and there's 100 people on stage with you that have all rehearsed and you're there. How do you alleviate the pressure of the, I'd be interested to know, like, I mean, granted you wrote that piece, it's coming straight out of you,
right?
But what is that like, and how do you?
I think every time it's different, you know. It's kind of like, in a way, I was reading something about this, or where basically it was kind of the idea that, like, if you're ever not nervous before a performance, it means something's wrong. Like, in a way, I think part of it is realizing that sometimes what we interpret as anxiety is actually excitement. You know, because it's your body. Before performance, you have energy. Like, your body is energized, you know? And I think if you say to yourself, no, I'm just excited about this, you know, that's one positive thing. But I think the other is just, like, I think the part of our brains that does performance, like, for example, the part of my brain that, like, helps play the piano, you know, is not the rational part of my brain. And I learned that maybe the hard way, but it's, like, the part of your brain which thinks about everything, which knows normal things, that's not what's playing the piano. The part that's playing the piano is some other part of your brain that's deeper and more subconscious. And so I actually think, in a weird way, it's like about getting out of your own way. You get out of your head and you don't think about it, actually. You just get out there and you're just like, I'm just gonna do, you know? I think anytime that I am thinking about my playing, it's never a good thing. But if I'm not thinking, the irony is, like, it seems like almost irresponsible. You're like, oh, I'm not thinking about what I'm doing. But it's actually, that's how you do it. Which is a whole weird complex that we have, but I've obviously thought way too much about it.
No, I love that. I think that's right. You kind of have to tap out of yourself as an ordinary human. Like, it's like, I'm about to do this thing that is extremely different from the rest of my day, the rest of my life, which is enter this instrument in front of a room full of people. So that is a different aspect of myself, and I gotta breathe into that.
Exactly, and I have to allow that to kind of do its own thing, you know?
Yeah.
And in a weird way, like, that's the bizarre thing. Have you felt over the years, like, that there are performances that you've given, times you've been on stage or what have you, in front of a camera, and you didn't even know kind of seemingly what you were doing, or you weren't prepared in the way that you thought you should be, and yet it was the best thing you've done? You know, like, I've had that happen where mm-hmm. I remember giving a concert where I really, for whatever the reason, did not think I was prepared for it. And without question, it was one of the best performances I ever gave. And in some sense, I think that made it even more complicated for me, because I was like, wait, now I don't even know. If by yeah. not preparing, I gave the best concert, now I'm just confused.
Well, I think the best moments as a performer are the ones where you're just okay with the mystery of how it's going.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how this is going, and I'm not judging it, actually. I'm just in it, and there are no boundaries. I weirdly just feel like I can do anything right now, and it's just me. It's my expression just coming out. And I think that's the place you want to get to, so you're not like strong-arming something into what you thought the night before it was supposed to be, or what you think people are going to expect of you to do today. It's
that's
like
right.
You kind of have to shed all that stuff, and you're like, I actually don't know what it's going to be, but I know I really want to play this song, or I know I really want to do this scene. I know there's some engine here for me, so I'm just going to do that. And then as an actor, you know, specifically when I feel like, okay, this scene is overwhelming. Like there was a scene this season that just, I was like, I don't know what I'm doing here. I feel like I'm acting a lot. Like I'm trying to achieve this thing that the scene feels like it requires. And that feels bad. I feel like a bad actor today. I just don't feel.
You feel like you're doing as opposed to like being.
Yeah. Or I'm like, I know there's an expectation for this scene. And so I should make sure like at a certain moment, I have a lot of excitement on my face, or I have a lot of, you know, and that's not ever where I want to be. Like, I don't want to think about what I have to achieve. Am I making sense?
It's like, because it's kind of like what I was saying about the piano too. It's like, you're thinking about it in almost like a success, failure, or cause effect kind of a way. And in a bizarre way, I think in order for a performance of any sort to be in it properly, it can't be about like success or failure or cause effect.
Exactly. Cause then it pressurizes it, and it makes it like, there's a result you need to get to for this scene in order for everybody to walk away and go to the next thing and feel like, oh, we got that scene. And this scene probably didn't even require that, but for whatever reason, I built this in. And in those moments, I usually just go, okay. And I have an actor, I had Jeremy in the room.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm just going to rely on what Jeremy gives me, and I'm going to back off the result I think I need to get to in here. And that to me always kind of grounds me. And I don't know how it is in music, if you're just sort of like, it's just me and a wooden bunch of ivory and you know, metal here. But there was something nice about, you know, if I'm with Matthew or if I'm with on any set with any actor, I'm just sort of like, I'm with a person here. Okay, let me just be with the person.
Just respond.
That's usually grounding.
I think for me, that's why I love collaboration, actually. That's kind of the answer to it in a way. That's why I think I'm so drawn to working with others. And that's why I love working with directors, you know, is because they have a vision. I get to receive that vision from them. And so no matter what I'm focused on or doing, I can always like, there's always something to resonate with in a way.
Yeah.
You're kind of free. You know, it's that sort of liberating constraint kind of a thing. Ultimately, you know that there is this vision that you will be a part of, that you can learn from, that you can discuss. And it kind of takes you, I think for sure, it takes me out of my own head.
Yeah, it's a conversation.
Totally, it's a conversation.
Yeah.
That feels exactly right. Look, I could just keep talking to you for another hour at least. Maybe we'll just keep,
I love it, man. I love talking to you.
It's great to talk. It's
fascinating. Yeah, yeah, really, really cool, dude. But it's great to see you via
computer screen, man.
And, great talking to you. I hope I see you in real life very soon.
Let's you know, hopefully in the not too distant future, maybe we can do a socially distanced, hello or you know, distanced coffee at some point in New York, you know?
Yeah. Just drink drinks close to each other.
But like fully, protected in gear of some, you know, visors and masks.
Saran wrap and stuff.
Exactly. Safety, but you will see each other. Yeah. Thank you, A24, for
bringing
us together.
Yeah.
And there we have it.
Thanks for listening. The A24 podcast is produced by us, A24. Special thanks to our editor, Tom Wyatt, and Robot Repair, who composed our theme.